People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
This is People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Today on the program, a home-sharing nonprofit is hoping to fill some of what it says are more than 13 million empty bedrooms in Canada. We'll hear from HappyPad, plus a report card on Canada's alcohol policies. We'll get the details from a researcher at the University of Victoria's Canadian Institute for Substance Use Research. Welcome to People First Radio. Alcohol is the most commonly used psychoactive substance in the country, according to a Government of Canada webpage. As a regulated substance, there's a comprehensive system of rules dictating things like where and when alcohol can be sold, how much it needs to cost, and how it's allowed to be advertised. The Canadian Institute for Substance Use Research at the University of Victoria has been evaluating how that system of rules works from a health perspective. Elizabeth Farku was the lead author on a paper looking at the federal government's role in all of this. I got in touch with her to learn more.
My name is Elizabeth Farku. I'm a research assistant at the University of Victoria's Canadian Institute for Substance Use Research, and I'm also a medical student at the Mayo Clinic Alex School of Medicine in Rochester, Minnesota.
And you're the lead author of an assessment of federal alcohol policies in Canada and priority recommendations. Why is this an issue people should care about?
Yeah, it's a great question. And so we know from a public health perspective, alcohol harms are very high in Canada. So actually, annually in Canada, over 17,000 Canadians lose their life to alcohol. And there are over 800,000 hospital visits that are attributable to alcohol use. And we know this isn't just an issue in Canada. It's also an issue globally. So, for example, we know that between those who die between the ages of 20 and 39, about 1 in 7 of those people will die from an alcohol-related cause. So it's also a huge contributor to premature death, not just deaths in general. And also, not just from the health perspective, but also from an economic perspective, alcohol costs the government nearly $20 billion annually, which is more than it costs tobacco and opioids combined. And even if you consider the revenues from alcohol sales, alcohol still runs an over $6 billion deficit in Canada. So there's a lot of health harms from alcohol, and there are a lot of costs from alcohol in Canada. So this is a really important issue. And we know that alcohol policies are the primary preventable strategy to prevent alcohol-related harms and costs in Canada. And so we wanted to look at this and really see how well the policies were actually measuring up when compared to public health best practices.
And what did you see? What did you find?
We found that overall, the Canadian federal government, so this was an assessment of the federal level of government, not necessarily the provincial or territorial levels, although that's assessed by a different component of this broader project called the Canadian Alcohol Policy Evaluation. And so our study that looked at the federal level of government found that overall alcohol policies are quite poor and they're not really in alignment with public health best practices. We actually found that the domains of policies that are really most impactful, so that's things like pricing and taxation of alcoholic beverages, marketing restrictions of alcohol, as well as measures to counter impaired driving, all three of those domains, which have a huge evidence base to suggest that they're very impactful to reduce alcohol harms, they all received very low scores. And so we found that really the federal government's policies in these domains are not in alignment with public health.
Okay. Federal government, provincial government, you talked about how you were looking at what the federal government does. Can we zoom out for a minute and talk about, I think, every issue in Canada? It's like, what is the federal government's responsibility? What is the provincial government's on alcohol? What things do provinces control? What things are federal?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it can be very confusing, even for us researchers, to kind of figure this all out. And so like, you know, other countries in Canada, as you mentioned, the legislative authority over alcohol falls under both the federal and provincial and territorial governments, and actually municipal governments as well, although the Canadian Alcohol Policy Evaluation wasn't able to assess municipal policy. So our study, as I mentioned, looked at federal alcohol policy. And so something, for example, that's very much in federal control is something like marketing restrictions. So in Canada, we have what's called the Canadian Radio, Television and Telecommunications Commission, CRTC code. It's such a mouthful. That's the code that regulates broadcast advertising of alcohol in Canada. And that's really under the purview of the federal government. And so really most of the regulations around alcohol marketing are at the federal level of government. You can contrast that with something like physical availability of alcohol. So that's really how easy is it to access alcohol in Canada. That tends to be more regulated by provincial and territorial governments. And so they'll set regulations on things like the number of stores that can be located in one specific area, the trading hours of liquor outlets, things like that. And so that's really under the provincial and territorial government control. And then a lot of, you know, domains are shared between federal and provincial and territorial governments. And in some cases, actually, the federal government can incentivize through tax breaks, for example, certain policies at the provincial and territorial levels. So even if the federal government doesn't necessarily have the major control over it, they can use essentially tax incentives to incentivize the provincial and territorial governments to implement policies that are known to protect public health. So it's very complicated, but I would say overall, a lot of it's shared, but marketing is definitely heavily regulated by the federal government.
So the big takeaway is Ottawa decides how people can advertise liquor to me. My province decides where, how, and largely how much I pay to get that liquor.
Correct. Yes, that's a correct interpretation.
And before, I want to dive further into maybe what you're calling for, what these recommendations are, but I feel like there would be a lot of people who might listen to a conversation like this and say, oh, the government trying to get in my life again. It's hard enough. The cost of living is so high. I don't want my freedom to be able to go enjoy a beer with people to be impinged on. What would your response to that kind of sentiment be?
Yeah, and that's a great point. You know, it's a great question. It can be very contentious to talk about alcohol policy for this very reason. You know, people may feel like it's impinging on their freedoms. And so I think it's important to recognize that these policies are not designed to take away individual freedom. The goal of these policies is not to take people's freedom away to consume alcohol if they choose to do so. The goal is really to protect public health. And so we see this with other substances like tobacco and cannabis. There are regulations around these substances. So for example, cannabis has to be in plain packaging. There's a health warning on that, which even alcohol doesn't have, despite it being a class one carcinogen. And so there's a lot of regulations around legal substances. And the goal is to really protect public health, not to limit individual freedoms. And really, at the end of the day, even if all our policy recommendations were implemented, people can still consume as much alcohol as they want to under the policy regulation. It's simply that the policies that we're recommending to be implemented are really going to nudge people to make healthier decisions because the policy environment will be more conducive to healthier decisions. But at the end of the day, if someone wants to consume however much alcohol, they will still have the freedom to do so.
And can you dive into a little more detail maybe on some of these nudges you would call on the federal government to implement?
Sure. Yeah. So I think one of the biggest nudges we know is pricing and taxation. So as the price increases or taxes increases on alcohol, taxing is part of pricing. People tend to drink less. And that's because people don't want to pay as much to have, you know, that can of beer, for example. And so that's example of something that's a nudge. It's not saying, hey, you can't drink this beer. It's saying that it's a higher price. So if you want to, you'll have to pay the higher price to get it. And so that's an example of something that nudges people to make a healthier decision without explicitly telling them what to do or impinging on their freedoms. Another example would be something like warning labels, which are not implemented in Canada yet, although there's a bill in the Senate right now, Bill S-254, I believe, that is calling on the government to implement mandatory warning labels with warning information such as cancer risk, which is something that alcohol is strongly associated with. It's a class one carcinogen. And so that's another example of a nudge. It would be a little warning label on the container that people would see, and it would prompt them to think about the health risks that they are undertaking when they consume alcohol products. Again, not taking away their freedom, but really providing them with the information they need to make an informed decision that might nudge them to making a healthier decision.
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh, and I'm speaking with Elizabeth Farcou. She's part of a project that's examined the federal government's policies around alcohol and made some recommendations. You've used the phrase a couple of times so far, class one carcinogen. Can you just explain what that means?
Sure. Yes, I should have explained that because it is not a well-known term. When we think about carcinogens, class one carcinogens are carcinogens where we have an extremely high level of evidence to definitively conclude that it can cause cancer in humans. So a carcinogen is something that can cause cancer, and a class one carcinogen is something that has definitive evidence that global research agencies have determined definitively causes cancer. Other class one carcinogens you might be familiar with include things like tobacco is a class one carcinogen, asbestos is another one. So these are all substances or carcinogens that are known to definitively cause cancer in humans. Class two or three, these are carcinogens where we have some evidence to suggest that it may cause cancer, but we cannot say with definitive certainty that it can cause cancer in humans.
We've talked so far about how one of the biggest responsibilities Ottawa, the federal government, has in regulating alcohol in the country is advertising. Can you tell me a little bit more about what advertisers are allowed to do and maybe what you feel like they should be allowed to do?
Yeah, sure. So this is a really complicated issue. So as I mentioned, the CRTC code, that was a code that was created in 1996. It actually hasn't been updated since that point. And this regulates broadcast advertising of alcoholic beverages in Canada. So that would be something like you're watching TV and you see a TV alcohol advertisement. That would be regulated under the CRTC code. And essentially, it provides a list of different kind of codes, really, within the code of what advertisers or broadcasters, actually, it's at the broadcaster level, what they can and cannot do when it comes to alcoholic beverage advertising. So one of those restrictions, for example, is that it cannot explicitly target people under the minimum legal drinking age. However, the code, as I mentioned, hasn't been updated since 1996. And so because of this, it actually does not cover newer forms of advertising like digital media or social media, which we know that the alcohol industry is increasingly using to target various populations. And so those types of advertising are not regulated under the CRTC code. And so there's a lot more freedom for the industry to kind of do whatever they want with their advertising. It's a lot less regulated. Something else with respect to the marketing kind of environment in Canada is that it relies heavily on self-regulation. So there's no mandatory pre-screening of ads by an independent authority. So for example, an advertisement can just be put out onto television without being pre-screened. The industry does occasionally pre-screen themselves. So they'll look at an advertisement that's been created by industry, and someone within industry will screen it against the CRTC guidelines. But it doesn't mean that there's any kind of independent authority who's actually doing that for us. So a lot of advertisements may be put out there to the public and then be retracted because they've been found to violate a code, for example. Although that tends not to happen very often just because it's a very poor regulation scheme at the present moment, simply because it relies so much on industry self-regulation. And as I mentioned, that code hasn't been updated since 1996.
So if I understand that right, we have this code from 1996 that's really built around, like, these are the rules for a TV commercial. These are the rules for a radio ad. And then beyond that, there isn't necessarily that framework of, like, this is what you're allowed to do on a website or a YouTube video or something where most of the ads possibly today are being put out.
Yes, exactly. That's an exact interpretation of how it is. And it's really concerning because increasingly that is where people are, right? A lot of folks don't watch TV necessarily as much as they watch YouTube, for example. And so that advertising on YouTube is not really regulated in the same way at all. And it's really not regulated at all when you think about it. And it's very concerning. And the code itself, as I mentioned, since it hasn't been updated, there's a lot of loopholes that the industry can use. So for example, there's no restriction on promoting alcohol for any potential health benefits. So for example, an alcoholic beverage company can advertise their product for being low calorie and can claim it to be healthy for this reason, even though we know that alcohol is a very dangerous product. And so it's a very outdated code that needs to be updated for sure.
I wanted to ask about what you just answered in part there of, like, what are the specific things you're worried about alcohol advertisers doing beyond, stepping outside the boundary of some kind of code?
Yeah, I think what concerns me the most in recent times has been increasingly targeting the products towards women. So we see a lot of alcohol advertising that's directed towards women using kind of feminine ideas and logos or pink products, for example. We see a lot of pink washing, as it's called, where actually some alcohol companies will show their product with a breast cancer logo, you know, with the breast cancer ribbon, saying that they're supporting of breast cancer research. Meanwhile, they're selling a product that is known to cause breast cancer. And so we're seeing a lot of that in recent years. And we've seen an increase in alcohol use among women that kind of correlates with that advertising that's been directed towards them. And so that's very concerning, at least from my perspective, to see that targeted advertising towards the specific group and seeing the harms that have resulted from that. We also know, and this isn't a new issue, that the alcohol industry continues to target younger populations and youth, even though you can't explicitly target youth under the CRTC code. There are lots of loopholes and ways to kind of target youth. So, for example, by pulling in celebrities that are known to youth and portraying them with the product, there's lots of different loopholes to get around this that the industry uses.
Are there any things that you feel our country's regulatory framework is doing well, is doing right, and we don't need to change?
Sure. Yeah. So we evaluated various policy domains, and the one score where the federal government, and I want to make it explicit that we're talking about the federal government, achieved a perfect score of 100% was for the physical availability policies of alcohol. And so those really refer to policies related to alcohol imports. The federal government doesn't have, as I mentioned, a lot of control in physical availability, but in the areas it does with regards to alcohol imports, those practices of the government meet best practice standards. And so that's something that our federal government is doing well. But again, at the provincial and territorial level, a lot of work to be done with the trading hours and the density of liquor stores and all those other policies we talked about earlier. Something else that the government is doing quite well is with monitoring and reporting. So we know that the government is tracking alcohol statistics. So that's things like policy changes in alcohol, alcohol use, alcohol harms, impaired driving statistics. The federal government is tracking those statistics quite well. There's a little bit of room for improvement. We can see that indicators aren't necessarily measured on an annual basis, which would be ideal. And there also isn't a centralized reporting system for those indicators. But that is a domain which the federal government is doing quite well, is in monitoring and reporting of alcohol indicators.
So availability of alcohol at the federal level, that's like if I leave the country for 2 weeks and I come back, I'm allowed to bring in X amount of liquor, kind of duty free. That is what you feel like the government, they've got pretty solid levels there?
Correct. Yes. The federal government has very much evidence-based policy when it comes to alcohol imports. And that includes, as you mentioned, personal alcohol imports. So going somewhere to another country and bringing back alcohol products. And it also includes the kind of broader importation of alcohol products. We know that they have to be imported by government authority, which is an important public health best practice, because we know that governments have stricter regulations around things that, as opposed to, for example, a privatized company.
You're tuned in to People First Radio. My guest is Elizabeth Farku. She's the lead author on a paper assessing Canada's federal policies around alcohol. The paper recently appeared in the Canadian Journal of Public Health. Relatively recently, new health guidelines were released around recommendations of how much alcohol people should consume, and it kind of made a huge wave in the media. Have you seen impacts from those guidelines now that kind of that wave has subsided?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I haven't worked directly with the teams that are doing this research, but from what I've heard, there definitely is some evidence that it's making people rethink their alcohol use at a minimum. And so I believe there was a survey conducted, I want to say it's the Canadian Cancer Society, perhaps, that conducted a survey and asked people whether they would consider reducing their alcohol use in light of the new guidelines. And there was a sizable portion of people that did say that they were going to consider or attempt to reduce their alcohol use because of the new guidance. And so I think a lot of those impacts have yet to be seen. We're going to have to do a lot of research on this topic to see what the impacts of that will be. But certainly, I think at a minimum, it definitely started a conversation around alcohol, which is important because these harms happen every single year. But only until really recent years have there really been a conversation about the harms of alcohol and what we can really do to prevent the harms.
How do you kind of balance that broad population level public health versus people's individual decisions, actions, responsibility? People will say, well, I am able to say, for example, on the extreme end, control my drinking maybe, or drink regularly and not have any significant health problems, it seems like, or I'm willing to take that risk. How do you kind of balance the individual versus the population?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I think there's a number of factors that play into this. One is that the industry, as well as other groups, have continuously pushed this narrative that alcohol use is almost in a dichotomy, where there are folks who have, quote unquote, problems with alcohol use and people who don't have problems with alcohol use. And so a lot of that contributes to this idea that, well, maybe I can handle my liquor if, you know, I don't feel like I have alcohol use disorder or a problem with my drinking. And I haven't really experienced any negative consequences, so I must be fine. It's kind of the idea that generates within folks. But what we really know is that alcohol use is on a spectrum. And while there is something called alcohol use disorder, which is a defined disorder that happens when folks become essentially addicted to alcohol, we know that alcohol use harms occur on a spectrum. You know, there are folks that drink, for example, one drink a day and still experience harms from alcohol, such as breast cancer. And those folks may not, you know, proclaim themselves to be a quote unquote problematic drinker. However, they're still experiencing a harm from their alcohol use. And so I think the narrative is really changing towards more of seeing alcohol use as a spectrum, much like we do with other substances, where the higher you, or the more you consume alcohol, the higher your risk, and that it really is a spectrum. And so I think that's a major contributor to it. And what I would also say, add to this, is that a lot of the time folks may say, well, I know someone who drinks alcohol and, you know, they're in their 80s and they're perfectly fine. So I don't believe this. You know, that's a common thing that we hear. And I think it's important to understand the notion of risk, and that, you know, when you're consuming alcohol, you're increasing your risk of cancer and other chronic disease. And that means you're increasing your risk, but that doesn't mean that you're guaranteed to, you know, get a cancer or have a harm from alcohol use. It means you're increasing your risk. And so I think we need to kind of reframe how we think about alcohol when it comes to that, because that is very important to understand and counteract those narratives of, well, I know an old person who's drank their whole life and they're perfectly fine, because a lot of people smoke their whole life and are also perfectly fine. But we know that smoking tobacco has huge health risks as well. And so I think we really need to change the narrative of how we talk about alcohol use and understanding the notion of risk itself.
If you have enough conversations about alcohol use and history, people will always point to prohibition. And that was maybe the result of a decades long movement of people who were kind of upset at the public health impacts of alcohol. How have these kind of conversations maybe evolved from what went on more than 100 years ago? And like, what is the destination?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I'll start by saying that I'm certainly not an expert in the history of the temperance movement or prohibition by any means. But as you said, my understanding of that movement was that it grew out of concerns for increasing alcohol harms that were seen in the communities. So people were seeing rates of cirrhosis skyrocket. People were also getting injured from various alcohol-related causes. And so I think in that sense, there is a parallel, because today we also see those harms that are still persisting. And there is concern from the public health community about those harms. And so that concern remains a concern even to this day. I think there's definitely differences, though, that have changed since that time. One is that obviously the temperance movement was very much focused on prohibition or complete abstinence from alcohol, whereas the messaging now is really that we want stricter regulations around alcohol because it is a dangerous substance. And we also want folks to limit their alcohol use, but that doesn't mean that folks have to get to an abstinence level or zero level. We know that the new guidance, the message is less is better. And so that's simply the message that we are promoting now. And that doesn't mean that everyone has to not drink alcohol or that we're trying to ban alcohol. That's not by any means what's going on now, as opposed to what may have been happening in the prohibition movement, for example. I would say another difference is that in the modern era, it's very much science-based. You know, we have a lot of evidence on the harms of alcohol, even from low levels of consumption. And we also have a really great array of evidence demonstrating the effectiveness of alcohol policies. And that's what we are using for our recommendations, is really the science. What does the evidence tell us is most effective in reducing alcohol harms? And I think that's kind of, you know, in contrast to the very much moral focus of the prohibition movement, which was, there was quite a heavy moral focus of, well, this is morally wrong to drink alcohol. And that's really not the case today. We don't tie in this kind of information to moral questions. We really tie it to scientific evidence and the research. And we try to base recommendations off of that, as opposed to any moral or opinions in that sense.
This is People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh, and I'm speaking with Elizabeth Farku. She's a research assistant at the University of Victoria's Canadian Institute for Substance Use Research. Farku is the lead author on an assessment of federal alcohol policies in Canada that was recently published in the Canadian Journal of Public Health. Another thing that comes up in a lot of conversations I might have for the show or watch center around controlled substances, illegal hard drugs, people might say. And there are a lot of comparisons made between maybe the harms that come from those and the harms that come from alcohol. Or there are analogies made of like a bar is kind of like a safe consumption site. There are a lot of comparisons and parallels. I'm wondering what you think it is fair or reasonable or safe to do, or what looking at alcohol can tell us or suggest to us when it comes to other controlled drugs and substances?
Yeah, it's a very important issue because, as you said, a lot of folks do compare and a lot don't. So it's a very complicated issue. You know, I think when it comes to other substances, alcohol tends to get less attention. I think there's a number of reasons for this. I mean, one is that it's the substance that's most integrated into our culture, right? It's pretty much impossible to go to a restaurant or a sports game or some kind of event where, you know, alcohol isn't being served nowadays. It's very much integrated into our culture. So it's very normalized. And people may not be able to recognize the harms that it actually causes. Whereas things like opioids, for example, which are not legal, at least on a non-prescription basis, are not legal. Those have very obvious harms to folks, right? They can look at it and say, oh, well, someone's used this and they now have a harm from that. And alcohol, it's different a little bit in the sense that it's so normalized, people may not see the harms as directly. So for example, someone may drink one drink a day for 40 years and develop breast cancer 10 years after they stopped drinking. Well, that effect of alcohol is not going to be as obvious as the effect of an opioid, for example, where someone takes an opioid and overdoses on it. And so I think it's really difficult for society to kind of link the use to the harm with alcohol. And it's a lot easier for society to link that use to harm with some other substances, such as opioids. I just use that as an example, but obviously there's a wide array of substances that contribute to harms in Canada. And so I think that certainly plays a role into this. And I think it's important to remember that just because a substance is legal doesn't mean that it's not harmful. I think that's a big kind of misconception in society that, well, if a substance is legal, it must be okay. Or it's almost like the government is putting its stamp of approval on the substance. And that's really not the case. We know that all substances come with risks, including tobacco, cannabis, and alcohol, which are legal, and as well as all the illicit substances that exist. And so I think that's something we need to take caution with. And finally, just to not compare the substances as directly, because they are so unique in their own way. As I mentioned, alcohol is so culturally integrated, which is so drastically different from something like even tobacco, which is very much now not as culturally integrated as it once was. And so I think it's we need to take caution when we are comparing substances between each other and the harms between them. What I will say when it comes to regulation is that we can learn a lot from the alcohol regulation sphere to and apply that to other substances, especially when it comes to the influence of the industry. So, for example, we know that recently the alcohol excise tax in Canada was set to increase by 4.7% to be tied to inflation, and it was actually capped at 2% due to very strong industry pushback. And so I think alcohol regulation really gives us a glimpse into the power of the industry that can influence regulations around substances in Canada. I think we don't see that as much directly as we do with tobacco and cannabis, but alcohol really gives us a glimpse into the industry's power and influence. And we know that this industry's power and influence is occurring with other substances as well. It's just maybe not as obvious as it is with alcohol.
So if all of the red tape was gone and you were put in charge and you could design the perfect regulatory framework for alcohol, what would you do? What changes would you make?
Yeah, it's such a difficult question. I think there's so many policies I would love to implement because there just really is so much room for improvement. I think if I had to pick one, I think the first course of action I would take would be implementing marketing restrictions. And the reason for this is because, A, we have a very large body of research demonstrating the power of marketing restrictions on reducing alcohol harms. We know that it's an extremely effective policy. And two, in our evaluation, in our study that we conducted, we found that marketing restrictions were very poor in Canada. They achieved a very low score, a failing grade. And so there's a lot of room for improvement. And as I mentioned, the CRTC code hasn't been updated since 1996. So there's lots of room to cover digital forms of advertising, social media advertising of alcohol. And so those restrictions would be very important to implement. I also think part of that would be disallowing this industry self-regulation. I think the idea of self-regulation is a little bit funny to think about, that someone is regulating themselves. I think it's important to have an independent authority that's regulating the alcohol advertising. And then obviously implementing adequate surveillance and effectively enforcing violations of marketing restrictions so that we can effectively ensure that the violations are actually being enforced and not just letting violations go.
So reforming the laws around advertising and then giving some kind of body the teeth to actually enforce them are your biggest priorities.
Yes, I would agree. And I think if I had to pick like one other thing to add into that, it would definitely be alcohol warning labels. There, as I mentioned, there's a bill in the Senate right now, so it's a very hot topic. And the reason I say that is not necessarily because the warning labels themselves are the most effective way to reduce alcohol use, but because I believe people have a right to know about the risks that they're of the product that they're consuming. And it's important that people are making informed choices. And the only way that people can know the risks is if they are informed of or told of the risks. And health warning labels can be a really great way to communicate that risk to the public. And so I would add that in there. If I was given all free rein and able to implement any restrictions, that would also be in there for sure.
I guess the nature of the study you've just done has meant that a lot of our conversations today have been, I would want people to know, I would want the public to know, this is what we should do on a public health level. What would you say to one person? What would you want them to think about their alcohol consumption? What would you want them to take away from a conversation like this?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so as I mentioned, our study was very much at the policy level, but I think there are interventions at the individual level as well. I think the biggest message I would give to folks is to consider their alcohol use. Take a look at your alcohol use. You know, how much are you drinking in a week or a day? And really take a look and reflect on, the choices that you're making and maybe read up on some of the health impacts of alcohol use, such as the long-term risks of cancer and heart disease and various other forms of disease that alcohol can contribute to. Another thing I'd recommend to some folks, if they're interested, is to maybe take a break from alcohol and see what it does for them. A lot of folks, when they take a short break from alcohol, whether it's a week or a month, they start to notice some benefits that they didn't know existed. So for example, they find they have better sleep or they are just feeling better from a mental health perspective. And so I would encourage anyone who's maybe thinking about that to try that out and see how it goes for them. I think overall, just taking a look at your alcohol use and really thinking about the risks and making a decision that's, in line with your values. And whether that means, reducing your use from 14 drinks a week to 5 drinks a week, or whether it means going completely alcohol-free, whatever that decision is, we know that drinking less is better. So consider drinking less would be my biggest message to folks.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to this conversation today?
Well, I guess one just final message is that we know that alcohol use disorder is a very common disorder affecting the population. And many folks, struggle alone and don't really realize how common this is and how treatable it is. And so I would just encourage anyone who's listening, if you're concerned about your alcohol use, if it's affecting your life or having negative consequences in your life and you're having a really hard time controlling drinking, I would encourage those folks to reach out to their primary care physician or primary care provider. And I would just encourage them to start talking about this with their provider and their friends or family if they feel comfortable, because help is available and it is a treatable condition. And I think it doesn't get enough attention. And I think it is such a common issue and it's important we talk about that as well.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you so much.
Elizabeth Farcou is a research assistant at the University of Victoria's Canadian Institute for Substance Use Research.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
A home-sharing nonprofit is hoping to fill some of what its CEO says are 13 million empty bedrooms in Canada. HappyPad is headquartered in Kelowna. This week, CEO Kaylin Libby made a presentation about HappyPad to Nanaimo City Council. I was able to follow up with him to learn more about the model.
My name is Kaylin Libby, and I'm the founder and CEO of HappyPad.
Well, thank you very much again for making some time. The goal of HappyPad, I understand, is for people to rent out their existing empty bedrooms in their homes to people who need a place to live and therefore help with the housing crisis. What does HappyPad bring to that equation, given that, you know, people could already do that if they were so inclined?
Yeah, certainly. So our mission at HappyPad is to unlock the hidden housing supply in Canada. So every night, there's over 13 million bedrooms that sit empty across Canada. And there's many reasons because of this, but a big part of it is many fears of people opening up their homes to share them or finding the right people to share their homes with. So really everything we do is about reducing the fears and uncertainties of opening up your home and sharing it with someone we like to call a housing companion. So HappyPad is not like your traditional advertising site. We're more like a matchmaking service where you can find people that have similar interests and values, maybe they want similar outcomes, and you can do background checks and connect with them in a safe, secure manner. So we're taking renting beyond just a transaction, which is renting a space, to become more of a connection.
Can you walk me through what the verification process is actually like?
Yeah, so a verification process involves a few steps, depending if you're the homeowner or the renter. But all users go through our standard background check process, which includes an identity verification, looking at a government-issued ID, and comparing that with facial recognition so we know who you are. This helps us eliminate bad actors or people, you know, faking their IDs of who they are. And then we conduct an international background check. So we check 200,000 databases in 240 countries to get a snapshot of someone's background, checking things like sex offender lists, fraud watch lists, negative news, social media records, and much, much more. This is kind of compiled into account. Then the next layer beyond that is your personal profiles. So this is your matching questionnaires, such as, are you vegan or vegetarian? Or do you love eating meat? Are you a night owl or an early riser? We like to take all of these metrics of your profile to help you understand who you are. And this helps with curated matching of people that have similar values and interests to make sure that you can share a home with these people.
If I've found a place to live through HappyPad, what is the legal status of that? Do I have a lease? Am I month to month? How does it work?
So it depends on the circumstances of the rental arrangement, but most rentals through HappyPad are not covered under the Residential Tenancy Act. There's a clause in BC that if you share a kitchen or a bathroom with the homeowner, then the Residential Tenancy Act does not apply. So we've worked with a team of lawyers to draft home sharing agreements, which are very similar to your residential tenancy agreement. However, there's special rules and clauses to help provide protections for both sides. And we do have some policies in place as well. If you are not compatible or if conflicts break out, that you can end that lease early. But the rental contract you sign is similar to what you would sign for a standard lease. However, the key difference is that if there's a breakdown, you don't go through the residential tenancy board for an eviction process or anything. We have an in-house solution of professional mediators and conflict resolution. Our goal is as a proactive approach. So instead of residential tenancy, which most people are familiar with, being a reactive process, something breaks down and you file for an arbitration, you go through a long, drawn-out process where really no one wins. Instead, our approach is we like to do regular check-ins, understand if the housing arrangement is working well. And if it's not, we want to provide some mentorship, some coaching, help resolve these little issues. And if it's not working, then we want to help you find a different arrangement, because no one wants to live in conflict, and shared housing, it becomes even more important than a standard rental.
How does that process work at the end if the mediation doesn't work? What happens, especially if I'm the tenant?
At the end of the day, realistically, no one wants to live in that constant state of conflict, and we will help that person find alternative housing. There are clauses in there to give a formal notice, to give a 30 or 60 day notice, depending on circumstances, to leave the property. So eventually we'll have to leave if that's what's decided upon. Our process is we do want to make it fair and equitable for all parties. But in the day, if it's not working, then something will need to change.
And I understand that you have partnered with government, especially the government of Nova Scotia, on this, and you're open, looking to collaborate with more governments. What does that mean? What does that partnership with the government look like, and what does it do?
Yeah, so home sharing is quite unique in the overall housing market. The province of Nova Scotia has been a very innovative government in Canada and very, very progressive. There's a few things that they've done. First of all, the province of Nova Scotia has fully sponsored our program in the province. So anyone in Nova Scotia, homeowner or renter, doesn't pay any fees to use our services. So they access our full suite of services, including rental insurance coverage, automatic rent processing, these background checks, 7 days a week, customer support and conflict resolution. They get a full suite of services for no cost at all. So that's one thing that the province of Nova Scotia has done to really invest in home sharing as a innovative solution to this housing crisis. And other ways are working through political barriers. So for example, in Halifax, there's something called the Landlord Registry, where if you're a landlord, you have to register your home and do an annual maintenance report on it, and also working with stakeholders for dissemination of our solution. So across Canada, we typically work with municipal government and provincial and federal government at some times as well. We've worked with Canada Mortgage and Housing quite extensively over the last many years. They've been one of our major funders and supporters in our program development. So end of the day, government is ultimately a key partner, and we don't want to cause conflict in communities. We really want to work with government to understand how we can use home sharing as a solution that ultimately benefits communities. We are providing housing for people that want to work, live, study, and stay in their communities. We're not a platform like Airbnb. We're not trying to disrupt housing supply. It's quite the opposite. And our approach from the very beginning has to be working with communities and working with government to do us in their best interest.
So if I've got this right, I understand it correctly. Normally in a place, anyone could have a listing on HappyPad in Canada right now. Well, first of all, is that correct? Do you kind of have everything worked out with the jurisdictional and legal requirements that I could sign up today and rent out some bedrooms here in Nanaimo?
Yes, we do. We do have supports for most areas of Canada. However, our program operations work on a community sponsorship basis. So we provide our full level of support for communities that have signed on to our program. So, for example, in regions of Canada, we've partnered with certain universities, colleges, and municipal governments. For example, the community of Drumheller, Alberta, has been one of our key program partners, where we have dedicated team and support just for that community. So if you don't live in one of the sponsored communities, we will still provide support. However, you will not receive the full level support of our priority programs. These are not-for-profit programs, and these do operate. We do have limited staff and resources, so we can't support all of Canada at the same time. However, we do put emphasis towards supporting those communities that have invested in this solution.
And the way it works, the way you get revenue to exist as a nonprofit, is both through agreements with partners and then through charging like a 5% of monthly rents to homeowners. Do I have that right?
Yeah, essentially. So we charge a program fee, community program fee, from the community sponsor. And this covers the launch, basically the overhead to bring a program to a community. And then our administrative cost to keep the program sustaining is through a monthly service fee.
And can you tell me about how, in a place like Nova Scotia, where you've had these agreements, what have you been able to do so far?
So support from the provincial government has allowed us to have a national scope, and we do have a team. We actually have four people employed full time in Nova Scotia that attend community events. They provide customer support 7 days a week. So in that province, we've been able to provide an enhanced level of support. and all just ultimately help to, you know, invest in really growing home sharing adoption. We've had, you know, many hundreds, I think it's over 600 homeowners now that have signed up across Nova Scotia and counting. We have an initial 2-year agreement there, and we're just about you know, most of the way through our first year now, and we've seen some great first results. Home sharing programs also typically take about 3 years in a community to fully materialize. So looking at academic research around the world of home sharing, and this concept of home sharing is nothing new. Really what Happybat is doing is providing a technology platform and a turnkey toolkit to make it much easier for communities to launch these programs. But international research has shown that it typically takes about 3 or more years for these programs to really gain traction and sustainability in communities. So Nova Scotia, we have seen some great early results, but it's just the first year of the program. And in other communities across Canada, we've seen great results. In Kelowna, BC, for example, where we started a program, we have over 400 home share hosts in that community. And we've had many, many great placements, many great stories. Our oldest host has been 94 years old, who I got to visit. If you look at our YouTube channel, there's a video of him sharing his home with his students and just seeing the transformation that he's had. And we serve many, you know, single mothers, young people just needing some extra income to help afford their place. So we've had, you know, lots of great stories.
So when you say 400 hosts in Kelowna, it's like 400 people living, 400 kind of agreements?
That's 400 people who have places available. So depending on the length of stay, some people might rent for a few months, some people might rent for a few years. So, you know, the rental contract duration will vary.
This is People First Radio. I'm speaking with Kaylin Libby, CEO of Happypad. It's a nonprofit that matches people with empty bedrooms to people looking for a place to live. Based in Kelowna, the group has agreements with partners in a number of communities across BC, Alberta, and Ontario, as well as one with the provincial government in Nova Scotia. And this week you were at Nanaimo City Council to make a presentation. You got some questions from city councilors. Maybe you had a bit of dialogue after. Can you tell me about how that went?
Yeah, certainly. So we've done many presentations to city councils across Canada, and it's an information session just to provide them context of what Happybat is and what we provide. We have had many inquiries from residents around Nanaimo and around Central Island. So this is just about providing them information for them to make a decision. Overall response from the council is very positive. We didn't hear any negative feedback. It was all very positive and supporting. There was a comment to definitely engage provincial government, housing especially, about this type of solution. And, you know, we are advocates for that. We do want to, you know, work alongside government to make the most impact possible.
And just looking on your website, I see that there are in Nanaimo a few different listings on Happypad. Is it so it's here in the community? You've kind of met that threshold?
We do have some. I mean, there are users across Canada who've used our solution, but in Nanaimo, we do not have a formally supported program at this time. Our formally supported programs, we do a lot more than just we do a lot of investment in the program. We don't have any current active rental contracts in Nanaimo. There may be some hosts who've registered, maybe just exploring and testing the platform out. But you know, we would love to support the community and provide them with the full suite of support.
Anyone could use it right now in the same way that you maybe like use Kijiji. But the difference between a supported community and not is those services like the mediation you're talking about and what else?
The key difference is that for home sharing to work in a community, it's not just about providing a tool. It's about using the tool. And when we work with the community stakeholder, it's about showing them to use the tool. The ultimate goal is after a few years is that this tool can be self-sustaining. But for example, in Nanaimo, there might be a few users who've signed up, but it takes a lot more to reach your criticality for this to become a sustainable program. You know, end of the day, we want lots of people to be adopting home sharing and using this. And when we first started launching these program partnerships, we just did it very informal, just you know, let community members sign up and see what happens. But we found that this hasn't really led to the results that people want. We then changed our model a bit, where we would then come in and work alongside community stakeholders to help them promote the program, to help them onboard users, provide educational workshops. This is really where these program partnerships come in. And we found that doing this extra work significantly changes the outcomes of the program. And that's when we can expedite the adoption curve and really start to reach that critical mass at a much sooner rate.
What is the scalability of the model? What's your ultimate goal within, say, a year, 3 years, 5 years?
So our solution is technically infinitely scalable. It is based on a software solution, so there's not really any technical limitations when it comes to that. There are practical limitations, however. So I say there's 13 million empty bedrooms across Canada. Our goal is ultimately to have about 1 million bedrooms available or spaces available. There's not always a bedroom. Sometimes it's a basement or a part of a shared house, another segment of a property. But that would be our ultimate goal. I mean, that's going to take more than 1 or 3 years to accomplish. But a good example is my mother. Is an example of a prime home sharing host. I lost my father about 5 years ago, leaving my mother alone, and she started home sharing, and it's completely changed her life. So that's one thing I really want to see, and something I've observed many other people have as well. So numbers aside, we care about impact. And even if just one person in the community that finds a wonderful housing companion and it helps them age in place, helps them afford their house, then that's a success.
We haven't mentioned this so far. Somehow I've made it this far into the conversation without asking how the rents at Happy Pad compare to, say, market rents.
So ultimately, the homeowner, the host, gets to set the price of rent. We will provide them some guidelines of what they can afford. As well, when renters sign up, they can specify their budgets. So we encourage it to be a mutual process. We found that many homeowners, many hosts, when they typically care about finding the right match first. They want a good renter more than anything else. And sometimes they're willing to negotiate or drop the rents, sometimes several hundred dollars to match the budgets of a great renter. So we don't enforce pricing policy. We really want it to be mutually beneficial. But we find that in most communities, we can be at market rates to sometimes significantly below, sometimes 50% below market rates, depending on home shares. And we also have some hosts that offer task exchange. So if you're a renter that wants to help do some cooking or grocery shopping, maybe walking the dog or shoveling snow, these are examples of things you can do to get rent reductions as well. Affordability is kind of the key approach. And also one thing that's really hard to quantify is the quality of experience. Living in a home share is quite different from just your typical roommate or shared rental arrangement. Hosts to home share, these are typically, well-established homes, they're mature household, they're clean, they're well-organized. You're living with someone who's been a long-term homeowner in most situations, and your rental experience is typically much better than living in other types of shared accommodation. So dollar for dollar, the value is usually exceptional, usually much better than you find on the market.
Going back to that matching process, is it almost kind of like a dating app? What is the interface and maybe the amount of connection you can have before you have to commit to something?
Yeah, so it's really an information-based system. So there is some curation. So if there's people who don't meet any of your criteria, they won't show up as a match for you. So there is some curation that goes on in the background there. But ultimately, it's up to you. We want people to drive their own experience. We don't want to force people to do something that they don't wish. So our role is to provide you with information. So the process is similar to that of a dating website, if you've ever used one, where you're given some information about someone. Of course, this is but not romantic connections. This is about aspects related to housing. So instead of asking questions that you might be interested for a dating situation, these are questions more related to how you use your household, like noise tolerances, your dietary habits, your cleaning habits, things like this, as these are more suitable for finding a housing companion.
And we've talked about Kelowna, we've talked about Nova Scotia, Drumheller has come up. Can you give me just maybe what communities are you in right now and which ones are you maybe realistically looking at getting in the near future?
Yeah, so we've got the Okanagan region in BC is our largest presence. The Lower Mainland as well, we have some presence. Southern Alberta, Toronto, GTA into Ottawa, and Nova Scotia are the where we have the most users on our platform. I should also mention that at Happy Pad, we also offered another program, Refugee Housing Canada. And this is a version of our same program, specifically to help refugees and newcomers to find their first rental housing in Canada. And this is a program that's had a lot of growth in the Greater Toronto, Ottawa region and Metro Vancouver. And we're in the process of expanding that program to be across Canada. So this will be rolled into the main HappyPad program. So anyone that signs up as a HappyPad host will also be given an option to house a newcomer or refugee in Canada. And these will typically be shorter term stays, so maybe 3 months or so, to help these people kind of secure the first housing in Canada as they begin the resettlement process.
And that as well applies kind of to the communities that you're in, that you're supporting.
Yes. So currently this refugee housing program is offered in the Greater Toronto area and Metro Vancouver. However, in the coming months, we'll be expanding this across Canada, working in partnership with resettlement organizations. So this will be community by community, strictly based on these partnership programs with community stakeholders.
Is there anything else you think it's important to bring to this conversation today?
Yeah, I mean, we encourage anyone who's curious about us to, you know, check out our website. You can even sign up for a profile to experiment with it. I mean, we have no barriers for people to sign up and, you know, test out our program. What we care about more than anything is just we want to see home sharing become a part of Canada's overall housing solution. We know that home sharing is never going to solve the housing solution, the housing crisis entirely. We're just kind of one piece of the overall puzzle. But if we can, you know, bring 10% of the national solution, then that's a significant impact. And that's really why we're here, is to remove the barriers and to really work with communities and community stakeholders to make home sharing a reality.
Kaelin, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
All right, thank you.
Kaelin Libby is the CEO of HappyPad. That is all the time we have for the program. You've been listening to People First Radio. You can also find interviews from the show on our podcast feed. It's on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.